Hey guys, welcome back to Caffeine and Crime. Are you surprised that I'm back already? If I could just make this a weekly thing now, that would be great, I know. But today's episode is Jodi Arias. Oh man, I have wanted to do this case for so long, and honestly, I've put it off. Like, it is. I feel like the best word to describe this case is raunchy. It's very raunchy. But it's raunchy, disturbing, and also so terribly sad. We have another, not even Black Widow. They were not married, but she definitely is quite the character. So we're gonna go ahead and jump on in. I've got my iced vanilla latte, and today is gonna be a long one. So let's just get the ball rolling. So both Jodi and Travis Alexander were born in California. Jodi was born July 9th, 1980 in Salinas, California. And we don't have a lot to go off of with her childhood besides the fact that there was a lot of tension between her and her parents, apparently. She was caught growing or trying to grow weed in her parents' house when she was only in middle school, and from there they kind of had trust issues with her and would go as far to go into her room and snoop around, and she just felt like it really broke her trust with them, and tensions were very high. She wrote about it a lot in her diary, and even going into high school, they had moved, I guess, to kind of have like a little bit of a fresh start. Maybe it was work purposes, but she just always wrote in her diary sad things about never fitting in. And it is sad. Like, she was a really pretty girl, and her parents said that she was extremely smart, but at the same time, her parents said that she was very strange in her behaviors. Her dad has even stated that he thought maybe she was bipolar or had some type of mental disorder, because one second she would be completely fine, and then the next second she was flying off the handle in rage. She would be very verbally abusive to her mother. And yeah, it was seems like quite the time in that house. Jodi soon found photography and she fell in love with it. She always had a camera, she was always taking photos, and that was kind of her escape from being lonely and sad. Now, Travis, on the other hand, was born on July 28th, 1977, in Riverside, California. And unlike Jodi, he didn't really have parents in his life. Both of his parents were meth addicts, and his father, I believe, died. And Travis and his siblings were taken in by their father's mother, Norma Jean Preston Alexander Sarvey. Long name. But, she introduced the children into the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints, and Travis really became involved with the Mormon, not only religion, but in the church. And as he grew, he would share his story with others and try to help and relate to other young people who went through having parents who were addicted to drugs, and really tried to help others in the church. He also would go on to do mission trips and that type of ordeal with and through the church as well. Travis was from a very big family. Jodi had two siblings, while Travis had, I believe, six or seven. A really big family. I'm used to that. I have a huge family. And he seemed to be pretty close to them. He graduated from high school, went on a mission trip with his church, and then when he came back, he decided to settle in Mesa, Arizona, which is, I believe, Mormon based. And so he had a church there. And he also got a job with Prepaid Legal Services, which is apparently an MLM, in the Mormon based area. Apparently, a lot in the Mormon church are involved in like multi-level marketing companies, and this was one. And on the side of working for this MLM, he was also still doing like inspirational speaking, sharing his story of his upbringing, and trying to relate with younger people who may have went through this as well, sharing his story and how he overcame it and how he lives his life the way he did. He also had a blog where he would share stories from his life as well, and he also was writing a book called Raising Me about his rough upbringing and where it had led him and how he broke the cycle of coming from a family of drugs and a very unfortunate childhood. And at the age of 29, he had his own house that he bought. He had a little dog, a pug named Napoleon, and he actually rented out two bedrooms in his house to close friends of his that said that he was very outgoing, very funny, and was quite the flirt whenever they were hanging around girls. Now, jumping back to Jody, in 2004, she had a boyfriend who moved out to Palm Desert and California with her. They had a house together and she worked as a photographer until she got a job working for Legal Shields, which used to be prepaid legal services, the same MLM that Travis worked for. I don't know about you guys, but I do follow a lot of people who are part of MLM, so I do see, you know, them get together for these events and whether it's like launching a new product or just like a conference in general. And that's kind of what Legal Shields did in September of 2006. It was a work conference in Las Vegas, and they had all their employees come out. Travel expenses were paid, so it pretty much was just a free trip to Las Vegas. So at this conference, there was, of course, speeches that you could go and attend, a lot of motivation type of ordeal to get you pumped and to get you selling. And also, I'm sure the whole look of being in Vegas paid for through a company is going to get your team to grow as well. So I'm sure it's the advertisement there as well. But they would in groups get together and go out to eat and that type of ordeal. And one night, a group of people, including Jody, went to the Rainforest Cafe. And they were standing outside waiting in line to get in to get a table when Travis came out and introduced himself. And he automatically went to Jody, and everyone around said that there was this chemistry from the get-go with them too. They ended up sitting together and talking most of the time, and close friends of Travis said that he seemed pretty close to her, and it was kind of relieving to see because he had been single for so long and they really wanted him to find someone. A lot of his friends were finding people and kind of settling down, so they wanted the same for him, and it was like he was getting that with Jody. Not only did they have dinner together, but they stayed up until 4 a.m. that night. It's that all-night conversation where you just talk about life and family and what you want in the next 5 years and talking about their childhood and literally everything. By the next day, Travis was telling people that she was the one he wanted to spend the rest of his life with her. But what held him back, she was not Mormon. Also, the fact that after this conference, Travis went back to Mesa, Arizona, and Jody went back to Palm Desert, California. Although Jody says it wasn't really anything to do with Travis, she did end up breaking up with her boyfriend that she had at the time, stating that he was married before and got divorced. He didn't really have plans to do it again, and she didn't want that. She wanted to find the one to marry and have kids and have a life together. So she said it wasn't going anywhere, so that's why she ended it. But she then had a long distance relationship with Travis. Travis was head over heels for this girl. And because of this, he knew he needed to introduce her to the Mormon religion. So he gave her the Book of Mormon. He invited her to some different church mission things. He sent people from the Mormon church to her house. I don't know about you, but I just know I mean, unless you're like the UPS guy that's has one of my packages, when somebody like that comes up to my door, I'm like, no, thank you. Oh man, I'm the type of person that I just am like, all right, let's just hunker down, be quiet for a little bit. Maybe they'll leave. But he was serious about this girl, and he made it perfectly clear how serious he was also about the Mormon religion and church, and wanted her to take it very seriously as well. I mean, some would say he took it a little too far by giving her paintings of Jesus, giving her the like church founder's biography to her to read. He even gave her a purity ring. And he also would quote a lot of the scriptures and such whenever they were having just random conversations on the phone, just trying to slip it in wherever he could, is what he said. You know, it kind of worked out for him though, because Jody had already been doing her research and she was already very interested in the church because of the place that she worked, that MLM that was so heavily involved, and almost everyone she knew in it was a part of the Mormon church. So she had already been like doing her research and stuff on it. So it was almost like it was like a meant to be situation. Not even a whole year later, Jody was baptized into the Mormon church, and she was baptized by no one other than Travis. And soon after, they made it official, their relationship, although it was still a long distance one with her staying in California and him in Arizona. But they emailed and called each other. I mean, this was back when, like, I feel like texting was maybe just starting to happen around this time. So there's a lot of emails and a lot of phone records of calls from them too. But when they were together, a lot of the time it was on vacation, and it was so documented because Jody loved taking photos and photography. So there's a bunch of photos of them. They always got together going on vacation since there was such a distance between the two of them where they lived. So they would just meet up at a destination for a vacation. She would take a bunch of pictures of them, and that's how they made the relationship work for a little while. They were like serious about their vacation and traveling though. They even had like this book, 1,000 places, I think, to like visit before you die type of ordeal. So they were actually going down like a checklist, and they had a lot of fun traveling around. But if you're familiar with the Mormon religion, it is very frowned upon to have premarital sex. And that was a huge temptation on their part because, if you guys know this case, I told you from the beginning it's raunchy. It is. They are raunchy. They are both very freaky. Let me just put it that way. I believe, looking at records, they exchanged like 82,000 emails or something like that in the course of their relationship, and a majority of them are sexting. On top of that, in a lot of them, Travis would talk about how Jody was his kryptonite and how he couldn't resist her and that he knew what he was doing was wrong, but he caved a lot of the time and they had sex. But it did put a strain on the relationship because, like I've mentioned, he was so involved with the church that he felt very guilty, like breaking those rules and passing that boundary. From what I've seen, what I've read, it is raunchy. Jody started going to Arizona and staying with Travis a lot. Their relationship got very seriously very fast, and she would come and stay with them. And that's when things kind of started going south as well, because his friends started picking up these really weird vibes with her. They said that whenever he would like even leave the room for a second, she would get up and follow him. It was almost like she was like just a little puppy dog following him everywhere. And they got this very possessive vibe from her over him. And they just a really, I don't know, just that really bad gut feeling. And even when I was reading this, I was like, that sounds so awful. Like, come on. But when I tell you guys, oh my Lord. His friend said that he would get up and go to the bathroom, and she would get up and follow him and stand outside the door to wait for him. And then if they were like chilling and just relaxing on the couch and he was texting someone, even like somebody from work, she'd be like, "Who you texting? What are you saying?" She would even like take his phone from him and like just go through it, all in front of like his friends and everything. But even behind the scenes, even not in front of him, she was like hacking his email, hacking his MySpace. And oh my gosh, there's also this picture. I'm gonna have to make sure I put it on the blog, but she had a t-shirt that said Travis Alexander's. I can't. So finally, Travis's poor friends are just like, "We've got to get this guy alone. We've got to talk to him." And they catch him in the bedroom. Maybe she was in the bathroom or something. And they close the door and they go in. They're like, "Look, we got to talk to you. Like, this girl, she's possessive. She's very obsessive of you. And it's just not a good thing. We're just trying to like warn you and stuff." And he's like, "I think you guys are being a little, overboard on this and stuff like that." And like, she will not leave you alone. Like, she follows you everywhere. She's constantly looking into your phone and, does not have any boundaries, pretty much. And they said, "I bet you anything, like, if you sneak up to the door right now and open it, like, she's probably gonna be right there, like, listening." And so Travis snuck up to the door and opened it. And she literally was, like, just standing right there, like, listening into their conversation. And that was kind of his friend said that's kind of like when he kind of had like an eye-opening experience that, okay, maybe we've taken this a little too far. Like, this is a little much. This was like a turning point for the friends. They were like, no. And they actually pulled Jody aside and were like, "Hey, this is too much. Like, you got to give him space. You're being so overbearing. Like, just back off." So she just said that she didn't really give a shit what they thought. It was just what Travis thought of her. So she wanted to continue their relationship, but she did end up going back home to California. But once she's back home, Travis tells her, like, "It's over. Like, I need space. I can't do this anymore." He said he was feeling very guilty about having sex before marriage and all of that stuff with his religion, that it was just a good idea to just end the relationship there. But this is where the relationship gets really confusing because I believe like he breaks up with her and then they talk on the phone, they get back together, and then she hacked into maybe like his email or MySpace. Somehow she finds out that he's talking to another girl, and so she dumps him. She's like, "I'm done," even though this isn't the case. Like, you can kind of tell she wants him back. And at this point, though, Travis actually, I guess, in emails begs for her back, and he even proposed to her, I think, like over the phone, and she said no. But they end up getting back together and then they split up again. It's just like a very toxic back and forth of, "We're together, now we're not, we're together, now we're not." Ugh. Their friends were like just completely over this shit. So Travis makes it clear to his friends that him and Jody are done. They're broken up. Friends are very relieved. Blah, 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 blah. But Jody still emails him nonstop. But it's like he's emailing too, because like he emails back. And so it's still kind of like maybe like a long distance ordeal. There's still the sexting going, all of that. When she finally emails him that she has a stalker and that she's scared, and the stalker is telling her that he wants to be with her and that she should be with him because Travis is so far away and all this kind of stuff. And looking back at it, like after Travis's friends seen the emails, they're like, she was getting at him inviting her to live with him. They just know that. But there's no solid evidence of that. I think it was just kind of like her way of saying, like, that's her reasoning for leaving. But, Jody to this day says that he begged her to come and live with him, even though there's no proof of that. She said it was over the phone. But I feel like, and I think everybody feels like, if he did say that, she would have moved in with him. So it's kind of like that probably didn't happen because she then secretly, without telling him, moved 10 minutes away from him. She left California, moved all the way to Arizona when they technically weren't together, secretly behind his back, not telling him, and moved 10 minutes away from him. Crazy. Like, This is movie shit. But get this. Oh, it gets juicier. She didn't really have a relationship with her family. You guys know the tensions were high with them. But she calls them to tell them that she's moving to Mesa, Arizona to marry Travis. Like they're engaged, they're getting married. And that's all they knew. And they're just like, oh, cool, you know, Jody's getting married. That's all they knew. When in reality, she secretly moved behind his back, 10 minutes away from him, and they weren't even together. And she's the one saying that she has a stalker. But then Jody's worst fear of all was when she randomly showed up at his house to surprise him and tell him that she moved 10 minutes away. And when she showed up, she discovers that he is not alone. He is with another woman, what seems to be a date. And she finds this out by just staring in his windows. And when he confronts her about it and stuff, he tells her, like, it's not cool. Like, don't be coming and spying on me. You know, this type of, you know, it's very stalkerish. Like, I've moved on. We're not together. But this does not stop Jody. She becomes so obsessed that she is at his house all the time, spying through his windows, like literally breaking in. She would like go through his doggy door to get into his house. Insane. And you know, I'm one to sit here and dog Jody because she is one freaky, crazy person, but she would sneak into his house by either breaking in, going through the doggy door, and then she would like he'd be in bed sleeping and she would just like go in and make like a sexual pass. And you know, like again, obviously, like I'm gonna sit here and dog Jody for the person she is, but I'm just saying, like, the man could turn this down, but he did not. He caved and these sexual acts would happen and she would get what she wanted and that's literally how their relationship went for a while. So just imagine that this girl is breaking into your house, climbing into bed with you, and you're just letting it happen, you know? And also, Jody told him that she didn't have a job, she didn't have any money. So he said he would start paying her if she cleaned his house wearing a sexy maid outfit. Again, I'm gonna sit here and dog Jody this whole episode, but I have to just state these facts because it literally blows my mind. I get Travis is the victim here, but oh my gosh, a line needed to be drawn a long time ago. Draw that line. He was trying to move on with his life. Apparently, he was seeing this girl, Lisa, from the church, and he was trying to go on dates with her all the while in the night. Jody was breaking into his house and climbing into bed with him. So Jody is back on her bullshit of hacking into his social accounts, MySpace, emails, and she sees this relationship going on between Travis and Lisa. And so what does she do? What any crazy person would do? She starts showing up at Lisa's place. Like she finds out where Lisa lives, shows up at her place, starts knocking on her windows, knocking on her door, and just like running and like just scaring the absolute shit out of Lisa. Then one night, Lisa's at Travis's house. They're watching movies and just, you know, laying around whenever Travis's dog, Napoleon, starts barking like crazy. And so he goes and looks outside, and who's staring in the window? Jody. He tells her she needs to leave, chews her out, she leaves. Well, the next day, Lisa gets an email from an unknown address telling her that she's a shameful whore, that she should be shaming her, and her religion and, you know, breaking the Mormon rules on being pure. And Jody, being Jody, takes it to the next level. And these people couldn't have a relationship. He would go over to Lisa's house, and when he would come outside, all of his tires would be slashed. It was just the awful anonymous emails and messages that they would receive, to where Lisa finally was like, "Look, you got a lot going on. I don't want to be involved with this." So she dipped. And so Travis goes to Jody and somehow tells her, "Look, you know, you need just help and space right now. Why don't you move back out to California with your grandparents? Stay with them for a little while, get things sorted out, and then we can talk about being together again. And this convinces Jody. So she actually goes back to California to live with her grandparents. I mean, Travis says jump and Jody says how high. But I mean, can you blame this guy? Like, I would do anything to get this psychopath out of my life. That's exactly what he did. And then he was able to breathe a little bit and kind of move on with his life. And Jody did too. She moved back with her grandparents in California. She got a waitress job. She also started doing photography again. And she even started mingling. And that's how she met Ryan. Apparently, she met him over MySpace or some type of social platform. He also worked for this Legal Shields company. So, it was kind of through that, and it was also the type of ordeal where he was like in the Mormon church base as well. He was from Utah, so it was another long distance relationship, but she said he was good looking, they got along, and they were going to get together and meet soon. And at this point, Travis is moving on as well. He went to a Mormon singles night and met a girl named Mimi, and thought that she was going to be the one, but she kind of viewed him as more of a friend. So they did go on some dates, but it never really turned into anything. But during this time, after finding somebody else and trying to make it work, realizing it's not going to work, who starts calling him? Jody. She starts calling, but at this point, it's kind of like he was all for it because they started having phone sex and strangely enough, Jody recorded most of them. So, yeah, there's actually audio of that, which is the very raunchy part of this case. But they thought that maybe she recorded it for blackmail, but she never like sent it to anybody. So it was almost just like more for like, I guess, her pleasure to just kind of have those audio clips of her and Travis. She still really longed for that relationship. Not long after this, there was a huge blowout between the two of them over something Jody had said. It must have been over the phone because there's no audio of it, there's no emails of it, there is just emails of the fight. It was very, let's just say it was an all caps email, and he called her a liar, said he wanted her out of his life, and it was very, very blown out. It was a big ordeal. Like he's done. Around this time, he actually wrote his last blog post, which may still be up, but I remember it being very disturbing when I read it back at this time, when this like shit was going down. And it was very straightforward about Jody, about how he was done just dating to date, and that if he was dating, it was going to be like a job interview. Like it was going to be the person he was going to figure out, like right then and there, if they were like potentially the person he could marry. If not, it was like, no, like whatever. I'm done with this dating life. I want to get married. And he even said in the blog, it's like desperately trying to find out if the person I'm dating is an axe murderer on the inside, which is such terrible, awful foreshadowing of what was to come. We're in May of 2008 now, and there is a burglary at the grandparents' house of Jody. And Jody said that she had left the house and then the burglars broke in. And only one thing out of the entire house was taken. And what was it but a gun? One gun was stolen. That's the only thing these people took from the house when they broke in. Very weird, but fast forward to June 2nd. She is going to go meet up with Ryan in Utah. So she drives an hour out of her way to a rental car place where she rents a rental car. They give her a red car and she tells them like, it's too flashy. It's more noticeable. So they give her a white car. Already like very suspicious behavior, like plotting behavior, if you will. So Jody was supposed to make it to Ryan in Utah on the 4th, June 4th, but didn't make it until the 5th. And during this time, there's a bunch of text messages and phone calls to Travis throughout it. Even voicemails talk of her talking about how she's moving on, how she's going to go meet Ryan, and how stupid she felt because she just drove 100 miles out of her way and now she's going to be late, and that's why she was a day late. So she went and then she goes to the rental place to turn the car back in. They asked her where the floor mats were from the rental car, and she told them that there was a Kool-Aid stain, so she threw them out. So I guess that's what you do. Meanwhile, Travis is in Arizona. He has a work trip to Cancun, another flashy place, where he is hoping to take Mimi, the girl who's not really interested in him, but he's interested in her. And he thinks if I take her with me and it's a flashy trip and we get to talk in, maybe it'll turn into something. And he is super stoked and excited. He's getting everything ready and sorted out and planned so he can go on this trip. He's supposed to leave on June 10th, and June 9th, the day before his trip, no one is hearing anything from him. He's completely silent. They can't get a hold of him. People start wondering what's going on. See, there was a work conference that was really important that day before they went on the trip, and he just didn't show up for it. And they were just like, that's not like Travis. On top of that, I mean, Mimi's thinking, like, I'm going to Cancun with this guy tomorrow and I can't even get a hold of him. So friends of Travis are just like, hey, we haven't heard from him. Mimi hasn't heard from him. So let's go over to the house and see what's going on. So they all go over there. They're knocking on the door and nobody answers. So one of them knew the code to the garage. So they got in that way. And this kind of alarmed one of the roommates who had been listening to music really loud. And he came out and he was like, oh, sorry, guys. I could have let you in. And they said, hey, have you seen Travis? And he was like, he's in Cancun. They're like, no, he's not. He doesn't leave until tomorrow. And he's like, I haven't heard from him. So they go in, they knock on Travis's door and they don't get a respond. So they have to get a key and unlock it and go in. And one of the friends went in, and when he did, they said they smell such a foul scent. Oh, you guys are already knowing where this is going, but it's an awful scent. And they look down and they see what appears to be a huge blood stain on the floor. And then that's when it really hit them. As I looked around this room, there was blood everywhere on all kinds of things. And one of them goes forward into the bathroom, and that's where they see Travis naked in a fetal position in like the standing shower of his bathroom. Mimi, on the other hand, she's looked and seen that blood stain on the floor and was like, no, I'm out of here. She runs outside and calls the police. When the police arrive, they see this awful crime scene, and then they question all the friends and they're like, do any of you guys know who could have done this to him? And all of them, Jodi Arias, look into Jodi. It's the tragic, crazy ex-girlfriend motive right here. Like, look into her. Where is she right now? Where has she been? These friends, they were not playing. They knew this type of behavior. Now, if this episode isn't trigger warning enough with all of the things we've talked about, by from drugs to toxic relationships, this is your warning here. This crime scene was so gruesome. These police go in to look for any type of DNA, hair, fingerprints, all that jazz. And they go in and find out, just from the look of things, that it was quite the struggle, that Travis fought back. There was blood smeared across the wall from the hallway that led, I guess, from like his bedroom, because it was almost like set up like a suite, so his bedroom to his bathroom. So this guy fought back. There was blood all over the sink. I mean, it is messy. I will probably have a link for you guys in my blog if you guys want to check it out, but I definitely won't have these photos on my actual blog. But the link will be there. View at your own risk. But it's just tragic. It's so awful. He was stabbed like 27 times. His throat was cut like from ear to ear. And to finish off the deed, he was shot in the head. I mean, so vile, so gruesome. It was a personal attack, and the police knew that. So, although friends and family and even police have this in their head that Jodi is a suspect, friends and family are just like, Jodi had to have done this, like, who would have done this? But there was just like no like key evidence to like pin her on this. So they have to move forward. They have to have his funeral. And all they really have to go on is that they determined that his death took place on June 4th, the day that Jodi was supposed to be in Utah, but was a day late. Well, The family and friends carry on. They have to have the funeral, and Jody finds out when and where this funeral takes place, and this bitch shows up to the funeral. I kid you not. She goes to this funeral and mourns the loss of Travis. And then she's back home, and during this time, she actually reached out to the detectives herself. Like, they didn't even call her yet. She reached out to them and wanted to talk to them. And at the time, she was told, like, you know, they don't have time right now. They will call you back. Well, they never did. Like, they just didn't make time for her. They were still investigating what they had to go off of from what they found in the house. So then Jody's pissed off that nobody's called her back. So she calls them back. She calls them back and says, and I, guys, I'm getting worked up, but like, just like, what? Okay, you guys are going to be mind blown as well if you don't already know this. She calls them and has a 42-minute long conversation about her time with Travis and how she doesn't live in Arizona anymore. She's in North California. So just kind of like clearing the air, like, you know, I was in California when this must have happened. And she even went on to tell them, she literally told the detectives that he had been working out and getting ready for Cancun. And they were surprised that she knew this. And she said, yeah, we keep in contact, although we're not together and I'm all the way in North California. We've kept in contact. But he's been working out and getting in shape for Cancun. So I don't think one person could have just done this. I think it had to be two people because, I mean, there's no way that I could have done this with how buff and how he's been working out. Like, I don't think he would be one person be able to overcome him. It had to have been two people. She has the balls to tell the detective that. I mean, mind is just blown. So while the detectives went through this house, they did find a bloody handprint like on the wall. So they took like the fingerprints from that. And also while they were like looking through the place, they seen just like this small speck of blood on the washing machine, which made them open it. And inside, not only were there like bed sheets that were probably bloody, but there was a camera that had been washed in the cycle as well. So they retrieve this and there's still the SD card in it. And when, I guess, you know, the really smart people who go through with the technology stuff and figure out everything about this SD card, they could pinpoint the exact way the person went through five steps on the camera to erase everything off of this card. It's just, it's mind-blowing that we have that kind of technology to really tell us that this person went through five steps to erase everything off this card. But what this person did not know was that they also had the technology to recover this erased SD card, even though they did the five steps to delete everything. They thought they knew what they were doing. And on June 19th, when this was recovered, the first picture that popped up was a very naked and raunchy Jody in Travis's bed. But here's what gets her. On the photo, there's obviously a timestamp of June 4th, the night that they believe that he was murdered. And going forward into the pictures, there is naked photos of them in bed, and then there is photos of him naked in the shower. And at 5:30 p.m., there is a photo of Travis looking directly into the camera with this fierce look on his face, water falling down over him. And it's believed that this is like the last photo of him. So although this is like the most disturbing and just fucked up situation, and the fact that they have these photos that they had to view of him in the courtroom, it's so awful and devastating for the family and friends and for Travis to have gone through this. But this was honestly the key evidence to get this girl. Like, it's just crazy. Literally a lifetime horror movie, like her obsession and love for photography, and that is like what pins her to this murder. Like I said, that photo was the last photo of him alive. Going forward, there is so many disturbing images on this camera of the acts that took place with 27 stabbings, the sliced throat, the gunshot wound, the photographer and her just kept on going. It literally is so disturbing and just fucked up. The photos aren't really explicit of the killing. You don't see Jody doing it. It was almost what the court said was like she had taken a picture and dropped the camera, and as the camera fell, it was still taking photos, but you can see like Travis's body and like blood and somebody else's leg in the shot, but there's nothing to pinpoint her besides the photos prior in his bed. So what is believed to happen is that she attacked him after taking those photos and started stabbing him. He fought and tried to get away, which is the smearing going down the wall, like running out of the hallway. And that is when they believe she sliced his throat, dragged him back to the shower to rinse him off, and then shoot him in the head. And I don't know if more stabbing took place then. Then she cleaned up with the sheets and took the camera and threw them in the washing machine. Why she would leave that there kind of blows my mind. I almost wonder if it was just like, she obviously wanted to destroy the card and like the camera and thought that that was going to be the way to do it after deleting them. But later on, she even asked the detectives, like, when they were interrogating her, like, if they had found the sex tape, because apparently that was also on there and that was never recovered. And when they told her no, she was like thinking, oh, good, you know, they didn't find the camera. But little did she know that they did. So on July 15th, they have all the evidence they need to interrogate her. They go to California to her grandparents' house, and they had already put together that the handgun used was the same caliber that was stolen from her grandfather's house or whatever. So they go there and kind of surprise her. And she had another rental car loaded with all of her stuff, including like some like knives, and there was like a handgun, and I mean, she had dyed her hair. Like, she was like on a mission. She was changing herself, like trying to just not look suspicious at all, and she was going to flee. But they get her, they bring her in, she's smiling and just being very friendly with them. They ask her if she has anything to do with everything with Travis, and she says no. She denies everything. Then the detective pulls out the camera with the photos and he says, is this you? Literally shows her the picture of her naked, and she goes, well, it looks like me. And they did check up with her like alibi, because she then like throws out like, I was in Utah and everything. And that's when they just are kind of like, yeah, you know, we talked to Ryan. He said that you were in Utah, but you were there on the 5th, not the 4th. And apparently, like, Ryan said, like, she was really happy. Didn't seem like she, you know, anything traumatic had just happened, like killing someone. She was really happy to see him and in a good mood. Can you imagine for just one second, like, sidebar, like, this poor Ryan guy, like, whoever you are, I'm so sorry you had to go through this. Like, oh my God, can you imagine that? Like, getting a call from the police, and then, like, eventually, like, when it all comes out and, like, everybody knows that Jody did it, like, can you imagine that being, like, this girl that I spent time with, like, probably slept with, went on dates with, and all this kind of stuff was literally, like, killed someone the night prior. Like, how crazy is that? Okay, moving on. She stood her ground and said that she did not do it, and that she said that, quote unquote, if she killed Travis, she would have begged for the death penalty. But still, she said that she didn't do it. The detective then makes it very clear that he knows that she was there. He says, look, we found a bloody handprint. And she's kind of like, oh shit, you know, and he's like, it's not yours. It is Travis's handprint, but it's your blood, your DNA. And she tries to still deny it, saying that my DNA is all over that place. Like, I've been with him there. Like, I've been there several times. Duh, my DNA is there. It's not me. But pretty much from there, they're just like, we're done talking to this lady. It's game over. Like, we have the photos. We have the evidence of DNA of you being there. And her reply is, can I have some time to freshen up and put makeup on before my booking photo? They leave the room, leave her in there for a while. And this video has went viral of her doing handstands, talking to herself, telling herself that she should have done her makeup before she came, laughing, singing songs. It's literally like the perfect example of what a psychopath looks like. So Jody gets no makeup, she gets booked, and she spends the night in jail. And the next day, she is ready to talk. She is ready to tell the truth, and she says, "I was there." No shit, Sherlock. They already know you were there. But she says that while she was there, two people dressed up in all black like ninjas came in to try to assassinate Travis. She said that they hit her on the head, or she fell and hit her head and blacked out. And when she woke up, there was blood everywhere. Travis was yelling at her to go get help. She said that she tried to run, but they had went through her purse. And one of them was a female. She said she was able to take her and get away, but she was so terrified that they knew her name. They had her ID. They knew where her grandparents lived. They knew where her rest of her family lived and stuff, so it only made sense to flee and dye your hair and run and not tell the police. When questioned, like, "Well, why wouldn't you call?" she said, "They knew where I lived. They were going to hurt me or my family, and I just couldn't call and turn this in." And this is when, like, the media went crazy. Like, we not only have, like, this love story that's gone wrong and tragic and, like, it's so raunchy, messed up, and just so, like, savage at the same time. But now we have this crazy person who is making up all these lies and trying to tell these stories, and also the viral video of the handstands. Ugh, it comes back to the handstands, man. So when her trial comes around, she's wearing, like, very, like, good girl, like, clothes, and she's now has her natural hair, has these bangs, is wearing glasses, like, no makeup, just looks like this good girl. And she's very, like, soft-spoken too, and the way she says things makes you, like, want to believe her. But, like, I don't know, I'm one of those people that I'm like, I see through that shit. But at this trial, they go through the whole story again of what they believe happened, and that their way of trying to pin this on her, like, she planned this for that meditated murder on her. They show to the court how she filled up two gas, like, cans for her drive so that she wouldn't have to stop for gas, even though there's plenty of gas stations from California to Utah. There was also, like, all of the texting, like, calls and stuff like that. The fact that, like, they couldn't pick her up on cell towers because she said her phone died when they believe she turned her phone off, because a little while later it was back on wherever, you know, when she was finally, like, close to Utah. A lot of it just didn't really add up. Obviously, they already knew that she had stopped at Travis's as well. So eventually, Jody takes the stand, and this time we have the third story. And that is that she indeed did kill him. But this time she's crying and saying that it was in self-defense because he was very abusive and controlling. And the first thing I want to say is, like, you're at his house. You drove to him. How are you going to now try to pin this on him that he was abusive to you when you went to his house? Like, you didn't have to go to your way to go to his house. But anyways, he was abusive to her. And she did talk a lot about how their relationship was physically and emotionally abusive. And Travis's family, his sister, she rolled her eyes and was shaking her head, like, the whole time. She couldn't believe that this was happening. And Jody went on to say that Travis would, at one point, shook her and said, "I'm fucking sick of you," and was screaming at her, slammed her on the floor at the foot of his bed, and, like, was taunting her, saying, "Don't act like that hurts." Then called her a bitch and kicked her in the ribs. She said that he kicked her again, and that time she put her hand out, and that's when she lifted her hand to the courtroom and showed that her ring finger was crooked. She also thought it was a good idea to throw out his religion and say, "Everybody thinks he is this good Mormon guy, but I have all these emails, I have these recordings on my phone of us sexting, and all this kind of stuff that'll show you the type of guy that he is. He's not this Mormon, Christ-like man that you guys are thinking he is." It's kind of her way of being like, "See, you don't know the person that he is, so you don't know that he was abusive to me," type of ordeal. She also had a phone recording. All these poor people had to endure all these audios and sexting
Shit, man, that was probably so cringe full to get through. But one of them talked about it was an audio, yeah, I believe it was an audio message with Travis saying that he wanted to tie her up to a tree, which they thought was a good idea to pull forward to show that he was this like very controlling person. But really, it was just a raunchy fantasy of her being tied up to a tree dressed as Little Red Riding Hood so they could do it that way. Because they were both very raunchy, freaky people. I mean, it's your sex life. You do you, but that was something they thought was a good idea to pull up in court and make everybody sit through. And just when you don't think that she can take it any worse or even further, she says that when she arrived at his house, she had snuck in like she had done in the past, and when she went to his room, he was pleasuring himself to a picture of a little boy. Yes, she had to go that far with this story. And that he then was pissed off and went and took a shower, and she then came in and started taking pictures of him because that's what you do after finding somebody doing that to a picture of a child. Oh, okay. Apparently, she then goes on to state that he got pissed off that she was taking pictures, tried to grab the camera, and that is when you see the camera fall. And that he then jumped out of the shower, attacked her, and she was able to get a knife because everybody keeps a knife in the bathroom, stab him in the back, and then she ran to the closet where she knew he kept a gun to defend herself. She said that the rest she doesn't remember. She doesn't remember slicing his throat. She doesn't remember the rest of the stabbing. She doesn't remember shooting him in the head. She said it's like she woke up and she was driving in the desert and didn't remember any of it anymore. And that's the story she went with, you guys. That he was a abusive person and a pedophile. That was her defense. So the day of the sentencing, she shows up with a white t-shirt that says Survivor in purple, and she held it up and showed the judge and all of Travis's family and everybody in the courtroom that she is a survivor of domestic abuse, and that she is staying strong. And yeah, she's found guilty, but the jury couldn't come up with a sentencing for her, so it was a mistrial. Yeah, unfortunately. But there was another trial. There was a whole complete new jury, so imagine them having to all go through this as well. Finally, on May 8th, 2013, after 15 hours, she was found guilty of first degree murder and life in prison. There was massive crowds outside the courtroom that cheered. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possible or possibility of parole, but she did like try to appeal this, and I believe the last one was in like 2020, if I'm not mistaken, which the judge was like, hell nah. So she is still locked up currently, and they've actually had to move her around a lot. There, unfortunately, is a lot of sick assholes who are drooling over her and sending her letters of that sort. You guys know the drill with all of that. Usually happens with these type of sick weirdos that commit these crimes and then are locked up. They have tons of fans. But yeah, she's been moved around a lot. I think her last place she was put, they didn't really announce where they were moving her, but she is locked up. It is such a messed up case. This episode is the longest one we've had in such a long time. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. But it's nice to finally have this one recorded for you because I know it's one that people usually highly request, especially when it comes to crazy female killers. But my heart goes out to Travis's family and friends. It is so devastating and awful, no matter what type of person that you are. I never want to come off as somebody who looks and turns a blind eye to domestic abuse or assault whatsoever. It's just in a case like this where there's concrete evidence of what she has done and that she is now playing this, you know, innocent person who was abused. Like, I just don't buy it. And, you know, if that was the case, I don't think that she would have just kept going back to this person. It's not like he was being abusive and telling her she had to be a part of this relationship. Like, he wanted her to, like, get the fuck away from him. And she's the one that kept going back. She was the one that was crawling through the fucking doggy door. Like, there's just so many twists and turns with this case. It's mind-boggling. And I don't buy it. I feel like videos of her and just the way she's changed her story three different times, it's just another Casey Anthony. Like, no. But yeah, I think it's sad because there is a lot of cases out there where women come forward about their abuse and are looked at as liars when they're not, and it's because of these stupid pieces of shit like Jody who claim that card and just a sheep crying wolf. And it's devastating and sad, and that is why this story is so disturbing and raunchy and just oof, all of the things. I hope you guys enjoyed though today's caffeine and crime. I am out of here. I am so tired after this episode, but I will be back next week with episode 7, I believe. But don't forget, check out the blog for more details about this case. If I forgot anything, hit me up over at Caffeine Crime Podcast on Instagram. Also, hit the follow button there. I would love for you to join my little Instagram family there. I post updates and all that kind of jazz. And yeah, stay tuned there for when episodes go live and come back next week for the new one. Thank you guys for listening, and I will see you guys next week.